All right, a few more people are trickling in, but we're going to go ahead and get started. Today, we're going to do a deep dive into Shredded Storage in SharePoint 2013. But first, what we're going to do is we're going to take a walk through SharePoint 2001 all the way through 2013. We'll talk a little bit about the changes that we've made in the storage model over the course of about the past decade, which will lead us into Shredded Storage, to where we're going to go really deep into the model and explain operationally how you can control it, things that you should do, things that you shouldn't do, and we're going to have a ton of demos today.
So a little bit about myself, Chris Givens, the CEO of a company called ACS. We do a lot of SharePoint courseware training, so if you've ever been to a certified training center, you'll see some courses, a lot of devs, not too much IT pro, but my blogs make up for that. I'm from San Diego. I am a SharePoint MVP, and I tend to focus on getting really deep into topics like shredded storage and other things. So you'll see quite a bit of the work I've done to reverse engineer a lot of what happens with shredded storage and the APIs that exist above it. We'll also, next little part there, the Inside Out book. I'll let you drive that. Inside Out book, we have a lot of books and stuff to give away. We got all kinds of t-shirts and everything. So we'll be giving away two books of this, and I have another one that I'll give away. We'll be signing a book, yeah. And lots of t-shirts, too. Ooh. Wait, Harry, you got it. That's a good
nice
resemblance, huh? These are good t-shirts. So we're going to have a lot of questions, so pay attention. There's going to be a lot of questions we're going to ask, and they're really hard questions. We're going to test your knowledge for those of you that are shredded storage experts like Mr. McNulty over here. So I'm not going to put him on the spot or anything, but so we got lots of stuff that I'm going to ask you later.
Great.
There we go. Yeah. And a little bit of other things. I do consulting other than the courseware stuff. So eBay was one of the big customers. I was a senior architect there, so I'm not just some pretty dev guy. I actually go out and do work and real world stuff. And General Atomics is, being in San Diego, I do a lot of government work. And so General Atomics is the guys that do all the Predator planes and stuff. So they use SharePoint to manage a lot of the operations and manufacturing processes around building those planes.
Great. And I'm Bill Baer. I'm a product manager in our SharePoint product group. I guess my intro is a little less interesting because I don't work on Predator planes. I work on SharePoint. But I'm going to keep the intro brief so we can hurry up and roll through this and make sure that we get you as much information as we can in the next hour and 15 minutes. So the agenda today, we're going to talk about structured and unstructured data, the differences between the two. We're not going to spend a ton of time there. As a 400-level session, we hope that most individuals in the audience today have a little bit of that down. We're going to talk about some of the architecture and its history that we've introduced over the versions of SharePoint that we've released to date. A brief overview of shredded storage and what it is. We're going to talk about some of its components. We're going to delve deep into the back end of our storage model. We're going to have a ton of demos. We're also going to test your knowledge at the end. We're going to have a ton of prizes to be able to throw out there during the session, and then we're going to have recommendations on what you should and should be doing with our storage model. So let's go ahead and start with structured versus unstructured data. You've probably all heard with SharePoint the saying that about 20% of data is structured and 80% is unstructured or semi-structured. That's a typical saying with SharePoint. Why? Because SharePoint's a collaborative platform. People are generally creating information and uploading it. Structured data, conversely, would be lists, items, and site data. Unstructured data, on the other hand, it doesn't have any specific format or sequence. If you think about a Word document, you think about a video, audio, anything that's dynamic in nature that doesn't adhere to any kind of structure, it's not tied to any kind of rules, and it can be very unpredictable. So you could create a document in Notepad, type a bunch of text, save that document, and upload it. It doesn't follow the same semantics as structured data, where it's organized into semantic chunks. So if you think about something like Excel, columns and rows define the data set that falls in between them. That would be more of an example of structured data, or a table inside of a database. So it has relationships, and it has attributes, and it has a defined schema. So if you think about some of the examples, EDI could be an example. A list that you create inside of SharePoint could be an example. And another example of which is all of the site data that wraps itself around the underlying data inside of SharePoint, the user-created data, is actually structured data because it has a defined format. It follows a specific sequence. So those are the differentiating factors between structured and unstructured data. Again, unstructured data, It doesn't follow any kind of sequence. It's not broken into semantic chunks. It can be just about anything, whereas your structured data adheres to a specific format or sequence. Now, when you think about unstructured data, most people refer to it as blobs, which is a binary large object, or you may hear people refer to it other ways. We generally use the word blob to
define it. It's not like this big creature.
What it is,
like
it's not. It's not a big gelatinous creature with little
googly
eyes.
Our devs don't really know what a blob is.
So for our devs, you're going to have a ton of love today, but devs generally don't care what blobs are. They just generally develop against that structured data, and the unstructured data is just something that follows along and travels with it. But basically, the blob is nothing more than just the data stream that travels along with that file. When I create a document, that document becomes my blob. It's the data stream associated with it. In most versions of SharePoint, except for early on, the blobs were stored in line or in parallel to the structured data, to the metadata that travels with those blobs. They don't necessarily participate in query operations. What participates in query operations is the structured data or the metadata associated with a blob. You have a number of different blob operations: get, put, read, rearrange. So if you think about downloading a file or uploading a file, those are effectively your operations. And if you think about what SharePoint is, we're built around the file. SharePoint has a ton of capability, right? We have enterprise content management, we have performance point services, Excel calculation services. There's a number of things that you can do from social to business intelligence, but at the end of the day, it's a collaborative platform, which means users are creating content, they're uploading content and downloading content. And again, that's about 80% of the content. So today in SharePoint, blobs are stored in data tables. Those data tables are defined by var binary max. If you think about mathematically what that means, you start to wrap your head around why we have a 2-gig file limit. That limit we actually hard code into SharePoint code. We don't take a dependency on SQL. So the differentiating factor is people say, hey, can I use RBS to get around the 2-gigabyte upload barrier that SharePoint introduces? And the answer to that question is obviously no, because we hard code the limit into SharePoint. We have, since the early versions of SharePoint, where we use the image data type as opposed to var binary data types, and the image data type had a 2-gig boundary as well. So from a blob storage challenge, a lot of people run into a number of different things. One, the commentary that we've heard is SQL server storage is far too expensive for the type of operations they're using with SharePoint. They want to move towards a CAS model or addressable storage versus a storage area network. So they feel like addressable storage or commodity storage is a more effective way of managing blobs versus an expensive storage area network or versus fiber. From a performance perspective, people feel like blob storage can be expensive inside of SharePoint because of the load that SharePoint can generate against any given SQL Server machine or any instance of SQL Server. And then lastly, people generally think about blob storage challenges in context of policy requirements. So in some cases, such as DoD, you may have a requirement to expunge. And expunge traditionally means that you need to take the blob, remove it from SQL Server, and place it on the file system. So you break the synchronicity and you put it somewhere else so you can actually expunge the content afterwards. So with that said, let's move ahead into our storage evolution. So if you think about storage from the early days, for those familiar with SharePoint Portal Server 2001, we had what we called WSS, ironically, or the web storage system that we borrowed from Exchange. The web storage system was nothing but a hierarchical folder model that we used to store content on the file system itself. So for those that are familiar with that version, you could actually hit the file system and you could extract the content that people uploaded. And you could interact with that system through APIs and internet protocols. So it did have a model that you could leverage to actually interact with that system. We then moved into SharePoint Portal Server 2003, and we fundamentally changed the semantics of blob storage in that version of SharePoint by taking the blobs themselves and their associated metadata and keeping them synchronized and self-contained within a content database. So that was effectively the first time that we relied heavily on relational database storage for both the unstructured and structured data. We move into SharePoint Server 2007. We introduce external blob storage, from there to remote blob storage, and then what Chris calls the awesome sauce in SharePoint 2013, which is shredded storage.
It didn't have an acronym. I had to do something.
So that's how we came to our shredded storage model. So shredded storage, if you think about it and you think about the life cycle of the way that storage has evolved, that's what led us there. So I'm going to go a little bit over external blob storage, and we're going to jump right into remote blob storage, and you're going to start to see the evolution of our storage model and how it came together. So external blob storage in SharePoint 2007 is when we introduced it. And effectively, what you had at that point in time is you had a COM interface that allowed you to separate the blobs and their associated metadata. It wasn't a net-based model, it was a COM-based model. So you had a COM interface, which is up here, and that coordinated the two separate data stores. The two separate data stores were SQL Server that managed your structured data and your external blob store, which managed your unstructured data. And it was very simple. It was simple semantics that recognized different operations. Remember the get and put, effectively file, save, and open commands. As we moved into SharePoint 2010, we deprecated our external blob storage model and moved to remote blob storage in favor of external blob storage. And we did that for a number of reasons. One, remote blob storage was provided by virtue of a SQL Server library feature pack. So it had a set of APIs wrapped around it. There was a number of different things that you could do. You could do file stream, or if you were an ISV, you could develop against our remote blob storage model. But what it did do is it broke the dependency between SharePoint to be building externalization of blob technologies. So in EBS, we built the technology as SharePoint, whereas in RBS, we leveraged technology that SQL Server provided to us. And we found that to be a more scalable model. Because again, you could optimize data storage through tiering solutions, which is what many people wanted to do with RBS. They wanted a tiered storage model. People wanted to use commodity storage or addressable storage, and remote blob storage really facilitated that. And if you think about the evolution of that, there was a number of ISVs that participated in that model and continue to participate in that model, one of which that we have here is StorSimple, which Microsoft recently acquired, that has a solution that's based on remote blob storage. So shredded storage, the question that we always get is, what is shredded storage? You can think about shredded storage in a number of different ways, and I know at a lot of people, the last conference when we introduced the shredded storage model, it's probably the worst feature name that you could come up with when you're talking about an individual's data. But the reason we called it shredded storage is partitioned storage just didn't have a nice enough acronym, and PS was already taken by PowerShell anyway. So we came up with this model of shredded storage, and what we were thinking about is file I/O operations. If you think back to SharePoint 2010, we introduced what we called MSFSS HTTP, or Microsoft File Synchronization via SOAP over HTTP. Most of you are probably familiar with that as the COBOL protocol. The COBOL protocol allowed incremental saves between client and server. Shredded storage builds upon that technology, and it enables a more effective storage model. The reason why is in SharePoint 2010, if I wanted to make an update to a file, it was a read operation in order to gather the file and bring it to my client. The save operation, when I saved the delta, by virtue of COBOL protocol, only the delta was sent to the web server. However, as part of FSS HTTP or COBOL, the web server would have to require a full read from the database server in order to coalesce the change in web server memory and send it back. That was the problem with COBOL. So COBOL, for every time you changed a file, that delta, which could have only been 20 or 30 kilobytes, effectively ends up as two reads and one write. So you're wasting a lot of I/O from that type of model, which is why we moved into shredded storage, which differentiates itself. It's the evolution of COBOL, which we introduced in 2010. And we're going to start digging a little bit deeper into that COBOL evolution and show you the differentiating factors between what we did with COBOL and what we're doing today with shredded storage. And then we're also going to talk a little bit about how we're taking that model into the feature or into the future. So the logic behind the technology, files are no longer monolithic streams. If you remember when we talked about what a blob is, it's the data stream associated with a file. A file is no longer just one big monolithic stream or independently addressable blob. So in the past, a blob was a distinct object. It was discrete and lived inside of your content database. Now, with shredded storage, a blob is no longer a monolithic stream. What we do is we take that monolithic stream and we spread it across what we call chunks or partitions. And we have a default partition size out of the box, which is 64K. 64K aligns very nicely in the storage world with block size. So that's where our starting model was, at 64K. So what we do is every time you take a file, we stamp it out into 64K chunks, and we distribute those 64K chunks into the database themselves. Each chunk is uniquely identified, so we understand how to rehydrate or recompile that blob when a user requests it and initiates a request. So with that, I'm going to go ahead and turn it over to Chris, who's going to talk about some of the goals, and then we're going to lead into some demos. We're going to show you how to manipulate the model. We're going to show you from a performance perspective what happens when you manipulate the model incorrectly, and then we're also going to show you what happens on the back end.
Absolutely. So goals, there are four main goals to shredded storage, and that is to reduce the amount of storage you're actually using. The other is to optimize the bandwidth that's occurring in certain points of the conversation, and then also to optimize file I/O and security. So we actually have slides for each of these. So when we say we want to reduce storage, when I save, as Bill just mentioned, if I make just a small change to that Word doc, then there's no reason for me to save the whole thing back over again. It's just I just need to save that little small change, right? And if you start to think about all the number of files you have and the terabytes and all the docs people are collaborating on, that adds up pretty fast, right? So anything we can do to reduce the amount of storage that's being utilized on your very expensive SQL server is a good thing. The other thing is to optimize the bandwidth. So some of the demos we're going to show you using what I've built called the Shredded Storage Framework will show you how when you're using Office or Office web apps or anything else, if you make that change, you will only see that flow all the way back to the database. That's all you'll see go back over there. You don't see the whole file get moved over. So there's a lot that's involved with just sending that little small part. If it's a 20 megabyte file, and I go and say, all right, yeah, I made the change, and I send 20 megabytes over the wire, that's a lot going over the wire. Just imagine how many people, if there's lots of people doing that. If you just send a little small one, well, there you go. There, you're optimizing your bandwidth. Not only does it happen between the client and the web front end, but it's also occurring, as Bill mentioned, between the web front end and the database server. If it goes and it wants to do a request and it says, oh, well, I only need that part, it's only going to go grab that part, right? So it's not going to just say here, oh, let's go grab the whole thing out of there, okay? So that's where the optimizing bandwidth comes in. And then I just mentioned the optimizing of file I/O when it comes between the two different communication paths. But then we go into security. One of the things that I love the most about shredded storage is the fact that it makes it a lot harder for your DBAs to able to get to the data. Practically makes it impossible for them. So I have a few blog posts, but I'm not going to go point at them. But back in 2007, 2010, I went and wrote a very simple PowerShell script, posted it, and said, here's what your DBAs can do. Maybe like five lines or something, dumps the whole database out, right? So totally bypasses any SharePoint security that you may have at the farm app level, the site level. But then you got to go say, hey, look, you hired your DBAs, you trust them, hopefully. Right? They're not like developers, you just trust the developers. Oh, no. Okay.
Yeah, and one of the things too is if we come back to the optimization, so If you think about read-write optimization, one of the things as well is each read-write with shredded storage, effectively what happens is it involves a read-write to the whole number of the file partition itself, which is quite interesting in itself. So there's two important things you need to think about when you think about that performance. So one, when you think about what overhead is, smaller overhead typically occurs with shredded storage when you're using a large number of small files, whereas larger overhead typically will occur as you're using a large number of small files. The reason that happens is because of what we call minimum read-write granularity, which is effectively the minimum amount per I/O processor that you can achieve per partition of a file. So if you request less than that piece of read-write granularity, what you're going to end up with is a read of the full amount, so you're going to waste I/O. The reason I bring that up right now is because we're going to show you and talk about how you could potentially waste I/O by incorrectly configuring shredded storage in your environment and affecting that minimum read-write granularity when you go through an I/O request. So
absolutely.
I'll turn it back over to security.
Absolutely. Piece. Thank you for that. So then when we look at shredded storage, because it breaks the file up into these smaller pieces, not only is it breaking those that file into those pieces, but there are certain headers and footers that are being added in behind the scenes in the database. So it's not like you can just go and say, oh yeah, let me go append every blob chunk and then dump it out. You can't do that, right? You actually have to make the calls to the APIs to get that file back out. So I actually have a joke on one of my SharePoint, on one of my blogs. It's like, the most interesting guy in SharePoint, right, off the Dos Equis guy. It's like, he can shred a file in one line of code. Well, it's like almost impossible, right? It's not going to happen. So the security that shredded storage, a lot of people think, oh, it saves us I/O, it saves us storage, but the security is one of the big things that you don't hear a lot about. That it's keeping the data hidden away from people that shouldn't see it. And there is now this new thing that Bill brought up at his opening yesterday, that he brought up the wonderful Fort Knox. I'm going to turn it back over to Bill.
So one of the things that we're doing with shredded storage, at least in our Office 365 service, is again, just some history on shredded storage. Again, it's the evolution of COBOL. So file synchronization via SOAP over HTTP was the precursor to what we call shredded storage today. As we thought about shredded storage, as Chris mentioned, it does have a unique attribute to it, which was it provides a security element or a level of security necessary in order to protect the integrity of a given blob, largely because the blobs are distributed, they're sequenced, and you have to be able to recompile that, which isn't an easy task unto its own. What we're doing in our service as we move towards the feature or towards the future is we're taking a single document, we're shredding that into chunks, much like we would do with shredded storage today. So we take that file and shred it into 64K chunks. However, again, that number is configurable, but we're going to tell you when and where you should configure it in a bit. But then what we do is we assign a unique encryption key to each individual shred. So now the shreds are each differentiated by a unique encryption key that uses AES-256 encrypted storage. So from a governmental perspective, it meets governmental standards if you think about FIPS in particular, like a 140.2 type scenario. So now that each individual chunk or partition of a file has a unique encryption key assigned to it, they then get distributed across multiple remote relational database systems. So now what you've done is effectively, if you use a shotgun analogy, you fire the shotgun, which creates a spray of shot. Those are your shreds. We then uniquely encrypt each piece of shot. Each uniquely encrypted partition then gets redistributed across a massive storage array, so you have no given part of a file shares, say, a spindle or a disk or a storage container, which we effectively called a vault. The keys that we use to uniquely encrypt each individual file are stored in a separate behind-the-firewall encryption vault. So now what you have is you have files that are shredded, files that are uniquely encrypted with their own encryption key. The encryption keys themselves are stored on separate hardware in a vault store, and then the individually encrypted shreds themselves are distributed across multiple storage, remote storage systems. So effectively, the only way to actually gather the information, say out of Office 365 and recompile a file, you would have to effectively steal our entire data center.
Yeah.
And after you stole our data center, you would have to steal our other data center that has the vault store in it that stores all the encryption keys. So now you would have two data centers full of hardware, and then you would still have to figure out the encryption algorithm in order to rebuild a file.
I think that's worth some applause right there.
So beyond that, and this is what we're introducing in the service, and one of the things that I always say is if you look towards Office 365, you can almost predictively try to figure out what the future of the product is going to look like at some point. So one of the things I didn't discuss yesterday, early in the morning, was what happens with existing customers. Let's say you're a customer today, and you're using the service, and we introduce Fort Knox, or this secure shredded store to you. A, there's no downtime. If you guys remember from shredded storage in the past, one of the things that you had to do in order to get a file to shred is you had to read it and save it back. So there had to be an operation performed against a blob in order to spread that blob across a shredded store. So in an upgrade scenario, SharePoint 2010 to SharePoint 2013, upgrade does not shred anything. It's the operation against the file that shreds it. However, in the service, one of the things that we're doing right now is any newer modified content will be pushed at runtime. So if you already don't have a file that's secured via our new Fort Knox encryption algorithm, when you modify it or you create a new one, it automatically benefits from that feature at runtime. We have asynchronous jobs that update all of the existing content all the time. That's one of the things that shredded storage didn't have in the past. There was no asynchronous job to update content. Users had to update content in order for those shreds to occur. So we have an asynchronous job that manages for that. So again, data's chunked via shredded storage, and then it's encrypted uniquely on every chunk. We take the keys to those chunks and we store them locally on dedicated hardware away from where the actual chunks themselves are. The access keys per each customer or account are refreshed regularly, so it's never the same access keys in order to access a file. And that's the other part of it as well. So you could steal our data center, but we're going to refresh the keys anyway. So you're still not going to have access. And then we store the certs and any access data even separately from the actual encryption keys themselves and the chunks themselves. So as you can imagine, we have stores distributed globally, so there's really no way to pull together a file in the future. So it's also about end-to-end security. It's about moving data. So what about data in transit? A lot of people want to know, what are we doing with this new encrypted store, this new encrypted shredded store? Well, data in transit, we've got that answered. It's SSL or TLS. At-rest encryption, we have that as well. So it's network and domain isolation, which limits access to the environment. We use BitLocker encryption to guard against any kind of physical theft. Some of this you can do on-premises with shredded storage today. You can take shredded storage. You can use BitLocker in conjunction with shredded storage. In many cases, it meets the AES model, so you can still remain FIPS compliant, and it'll protect you against physical theft. So it's a good way to perform encryption at rest if TDE isn't a viable candidate. It also guards against logical theft, and that's what Chris was talking about. So Chris was talking about security. In past versions of SharePoint where we stored a file as a monolithic stream, you could actually extract the blob, so it didn't protect your content from logical theft. Now, with shredded store and an encrypted shredded store, you're actually you're protecting yourself both against physical and logical theft of your data. And then the secrets, the keys to the keys. So I talked about how we encrypt, we refresh the keys, we have certificates, and we have access control and monitoring. So the keys to the keys is what we call the secret. So there's a key to the key, which is an interesting concept in itself. They're also encrypted at rest. So not only have we encrypted every chunk, not only does each key have a key pair, but we also take the key to that key and we store it on its own encrypted storage. So again, we're holding everything in a secure store. Effectively, it becomes one enormous vault, which is why we refer to it as Fort Knox. From an operational perspective, if you think about, well, at Microsoft, you guys still have engineers that may mess with my data. That's always the big concern. Who has access to my data? We have time-bound security control, so it requires approval to perform specific actions. It's scoped to the minimal set of actions that are necessary for the task. So if it's just updating the user gets updated, we don't do anything else. And today we only have 10 engineers that have standing access to your data. If you think about the size of the service and the petabytes of data that are stored in there and the breadth of the SharePoint farms that we host with over 800,000 cores at 20,000 servers, adding 2,000 per month, running at 20,000 RPS each and every day. And to put that into perspective, every minute there's 5,700 tweets sent. We're doing 2,000 requests per second against that environment every day, and we only have 10 engineers that have standing access to the data center itself, to where all the data is, and in the future that's going to be zero. So, you know, from a Fort Knox perspective, that's why we refer to it as such. It's kind of the evolution of the shredded store. And again, if you start looking towards Office 365 and you start looking towards SharePoint Online, you start to see how these features will eventually make themselves available to you. If you think about what shredded store is, shredded store we initially designed in order to facilitate performance inside of Office 365. And it became part of our on-prem product when we shipped SharePoint 2013. So we're going to continue to make investments in this type of model. But before we talk a little bit more about kind of the future of what we're doing from a storage perspective, I'm going to let Chris kind of delve into some of the content database changes that Shredded Store makes so you can understand the model a little bit better. And then we're going to get into some best practices from here.
Thank you. You got to love Bill. He's always giving us all this amazing information. So that's why he's awesome. So content database changes. A lot of you, when I look around the audience, a lot of you have kind of delved into a lot of this. A lot of you are like, oh, don't look at the database. Don't touch it. You can look, just don't run queries against it, right? So everything I'm going to show you is simply for demo, right? But when we look at the content database itself in 2013 to support shredded storage, there obviously had to be schema changes to be able to handle being able to rip apart a file and then put the file back again, right? So there is a new table that the docs to stream that keeps track of all of the parts, all of the shreds, right? And so what I'm going to do is I'm actually, when I look at our time, we have lots of demos. So I'm going to make sure to show you guys these tables and actually how this works. Now, because things get smaller, we can think about transaction logs, and Bill loves that part. I know he's one of his favorite features. Because you're changing just one small thing instead of changing 20 meg, obviously the transaction log is going to be smaller, isn't it? So if you're doing things like log shipping and all that, smaller, and it takes a lot less time. So we love the fact that that was one thing we didn't really put in the goals over there, but it kind of was implicitly implied that's occurring. Now, if I'm shredding things, if I'm taking a file and I'm tearing it apart, I obviously got to be able to put it back together again, which means I need a guide, something that's going to tell me how do I put the pieces back and append them in terms of the binary. And so that's what we call the BSN. And so it's just a number, right? So you just kind of order it from low to high, and you say, okay, this is the mapping of the ones I want. Put it back together, okay? So with that, like I said, I want to show you demos. So number five. So we have here a beautiful content database that has all these tables. Now, I could go and run, look at all the tables and expand it out, but I'm not. I'm just going to point to the main things. If we look at the all docs table, that's what that holds a lot of this, the file wrapper, not necessarily the metadata of the columns, but a lot of the more specific things is in terms of what's its path when you go and actually request for a file from a document library. It's going to store a lot of that. Now, when we look at it, there's actually some important parts that we care about in terms of what's in this table. So I actually have a document called text.docx, which tends to be the, when I show you the shredded storage framework, that's just the one I, oh, so sorry. What do we got? Windows Plus. No, don't do that. Whale. It's not so happy with the really big screen here. Yeah, I got, yeah. Windows Plus. Windows minus minus. It's doing, it's jumping up top with this screen resolution. Do at the bottom. Sorry. Say it one more time. Sorry.
You have to expand the beyond to make it beyond take over the screen, and then it will capture
left or right? Sorry. Oh, gotcha. This guy. There you go. All right. Thank you.
All right. Much. All of that.
Yeah. Yeah.
So you know what? There's your Zoom demo for the day. Thanks for coming.
Yeah.
So
there's your Zoom demo. Okay, there we go.
So, all of that. So hopefully everybody can see it again, because we are not going to do that exercise one more time.
Yeah. So.
Good thing we're in Vegas. Yeah. Good thing we're in Vegas, and I can get a drink after this.
Yeah, me too. So these are the important parts that are sitting here. So we need the ID that gets generated for the file. So obviously that's a GUID. We need the BSN. This next BSN is when I go to update the file, when it wants to go generate new shreds, if I change something, that's where it's going to start when it generates some new things. There's a few tests we're going to run through when we test your knowledge. And by the way, get your phones ready. I know a lot of you are probably from outside the country, so I don't want you to get teched. I mean, I have some money in my pocket. I can help pay for some of the text process. But we're going to ask you some questions, and you can text your answers. You can tweet them in. You can go to a page for it. But have your phones ready. We're going to ask you some questions. So the stream schema is something that there's an algorithm that runs when it looks at the file and says, okay, what am I going to do with you? There's multiple different algorithms depending on the type of file. And so this keeps track of when it goes to rebuild. Does it have a header? Does it not? And it puts it back together again. So in addition, if we look at the other tables that has the actual shreds in it, we will see what shreds make up this file. At some point, after all the refreshing. And so executing this, and again, you know, this is not something you're going to want to go and do and just test in your production environment, so please don't do that.
And so there's probably about 100 people out there right now saying, hey, I thought support documentation said never look at your databases. But obviously, in order for us to at least show you in terms of what's happening with your files once they've been shredded, to put things into context, because all of this is going to lead to when you should start to manipulate the right chunk size of a given shred and when you should not, and then how that proportionally matches to our read chunk size. So now that we've got our shreds.
We have that original doc ID that was tied to the document is sitting there. The partition, which comes into play a little bit later when you do things like Office web apps, and you have multi-editing sessions. But there's our BSN. So you'll notice it says 5,044, 45, 46. Well, it's because I said order by BSN. That's where we'd start. It's in that order. We append the content together. And then that becomes the original binary. However, the way the COBOL works is it's actually adding in different parts to this. So if I scroll over a little bit, we'll see there's a type in here as well. So there's a type 11, type 10. In the algorithms, everything that's happening with COBOL, these end up having special little things in them that kind of tell the web front end kind of hashes of, oh, I just want this. This didn't change, or this did change, without it having to go and pull all of these down. Right? Wow! Yay! That's where we gain in the network bandwidth optimization. It doesn't have to pull all these down to know if they've actually changed or not. So with that, we're going to switch back over, and we're going to talk about now that you've seen how that storage layer happens and it gets broken apart. There are all these applications that sit above it, and so Bill's going to talk about one very important one that will drive what the settings will be for your file write and read chunk sizes.
All right, so we're going to take another a trip down history. And it's too bad we had so many problems with the Zoom stuff, because I was going to show you what the next version of SharePoint looks like as a demo. But since we had so many view problems, I'll just skip it till next time we meet here at SPC. Right. So we'll talk about the client applications, some of the protocols, impacts, and consideration. So this is the important stuff that you need to start thinking about right now. How many people are familiar with what we call file write chunk size? And I know everybody hates raising their hand in a conference. So I'm gonna assume that many of you are familiar with what file size write chunk size is. Effectively, what the file write chunk size is it determines the size of the chunk that we create when a given file is uploaded. It can be anything from 64K up to our maximum file boundary, which is 2 gig. So a lot of people assume, okay, I've seen this shredded storage thing, I'm using RBS or I'm using another technology to externalize my unstructured data, so I don't necessarily want it to be a bunch of small files because I'm concerned about performance penalties that I may occur on my addressable storage system or my remote blob storage system because I have a large number of small files now. So what I'm going to go ahead and do is I'm going to go ahead and just crank up the file write chunk size to 2 gigabytes. That's going to be awesome, because now I'm going to have a monolithic stream again. You're not going to have a monolithic stream again. It's a COBOL blob. The old days of SharePoint 2010, 2007, 2003, and 2001 are gone. They're COBOL blobs from now on. COBOL blobs are comprised of a number of different things. There's a data element cache. There's a master index. There's the blob itself. There's always effectively really 3 blobs at any given point in time associated with a given piece of content. So why is this important? Why should you not manipulate that number? Or when you do manipulate that number, Chris and I are going to make some recommendations to which they should be. There's a boundary or a range that you should be looking at. So 2 gig is what a lot of people like to do. Other people say, you know what, I'm going to set it at like 100 megs because my average file is, say, 80, so that way I still have the monolithic stream. It's not true. Back in Windows Vista, we worked on a project called Sapphire. Sapphire was effectively the consolidation of our native, or it was a native SOAP stack. It was a consolidation effort on behalf of our Windows team. So if you think about some of the protocols and some of the stacks that we've consolidated, we have them here. You shouldn't really, most people thought about what Sapphire is when they read the protocol documentation associated with Windows Vista was WSF Lite. It's a peer, it's not necessarily a replacement, but it has a huge impact on shredded storage. So now as we're looking at the evolution of our storage model, we've talked about 2001 up to 2013, but now we're talking about the client operating system. So we're taking a completely different path and we're diverting in another direction, and most of you are wondering why. So SharePoint 2013 itself, did you switch it on me? I accidentally did that. All right, so SharePoint 2013 itself implements WCF and Windows SOAP Stack to manage the incremental change in synchronization of files within the context of client applications. What are client applications? OneDrive for Business, or what we formerly called the artist formerly known as SkyDrive Pro, is OneDrive for Business. I heard he plays a mean guitar and he wears like chaps. But anyway, so there's OneDrive for Business, which was formerly SkyDrive Pro. There's also the client applications such as Excel, PowerPoint, Word, any number of different files that you could save themselves from the client. So basically what we have is the transfer between client and server is all dependent on this native code. It's all dependent on our Windows Sapphire SOAP stack that we built into Windows Vista that we've carried forward all the way through Windows 7 and all the way into Windows 8.1. So basically we designed this implementation to facilitate co-authoring, and we're going to show you a few things here in a moment as Chris is working to bring it up. But basically, in order to perform efficient file I/O and to make that transfer happen and to be able to perform incremental sync by virtue of COBOL, a client read inside of the Sapphire stack is limited to 3 meg. So that's the important piece. That's the takeaway piece right there. If you think about the Sapphire stack, the Windows native SOAP stack that we built, and the fact that SharePoint 2013 honors and leverages the Windows native SOAP stack, a client read is limited to 3 megs by virtue of Sapphire. So if you start thinking about compound operations and file write chunk size, the problem is going to become immediately aware. So let's say I set my file write chunk size to, oh, I don't know, and Chris is working on that right now, but let's say I take a file write chunk size and I set it to 3 megabytes. So I have a 3 meg file.
Don't give me away the question answers now.
And now I have a file that's 9 megabytes. I'm going to have to perform 3 compound operations in order to retrieve that file. 3 times 3 equals 9. The Windows native SOAP stack says you can have 3 megs at a time. File write chunk size is telling my database server what it can have. To put it into better perspective, let's take that same thing. I've got a file write chunk size of, say, 100 megabytes. Right? So I increased it significantly. It's a pretty substantial number. And I want to be able to get that file and download it and edit it via a client application. So I'm synchronizing via OneDrive. So here's the interesting thing. The Sapphire SOAP stack on the client, OneDrive, that has a dependency on it, says you can have 3 megs at a time. SharePoint says, because you've configured file write chunk size, you can have 100 megs at a time. So for every 3 megabytes that OneDrive requests to synchronize, you're paying a penalty of 100 megabyte in I/O on your database server. Another way to put that is for those that want to set it to 2 gigabytes because they feel like they're going to end up with a monolithic stream, for that same operation, for every 3 megabytes synchronized via a client application, you're paying a 2 gigabyte I/O penalty on the back end. Why? Because the client honors the native SoapStack or Sapphire, so it limits itself to 3 megabyte synchronization, so 3 meg partitions is the most it can read, but you've set file write chunk size to 2 gigabytes. So between SharePoint and SQL, a 2 gigabyte read occurs, but between the front end and the client, only a 3 megabyte change can occur. So now you've got 2 gigs for every 3 gigs. 2 gigs of I/O for, or 2 gigs of I/O for every 3 megabyte read request that the file generates. That deal becomes much, much bigger if you think about OneDrive and you think about people, what they want to do today is, what do all of your users want to do? Store, share, sync. Box, Dropbox, SkyDrive, OneDrive for business. So if you think about that, you have thousands of users potentially synchronizing files. You've set your write chunk size to 2 gigabytes. All of their clients are only reading 3 megabyte partitions. So if you have 2 users that are synchronizing a file, for every 6 megabytes they synchronize, you're paying 4 gigabyte in I/O penalty on your back end. And as you start thinking about compound operations, it's just going to continue to grow. So once you have hundreds of users synchronizing, thousands of users synchronizing, effectively what's going to happen is your storage system is going to fall over because you're going to run out of available I/O in order to perform the operations. You're going to spend a ton of time trying to troubleshoot why that's happening because you're going to say, hey, I've only got about 100 users synchronizing some files. That's because those 100 users, every 3 megs, 100 users times 3 megs, 300 users, 300 users times 2 gigabytes, you know, 600 gigs I/O just to download 300 megs. You can't even download most songs these days, you know, that are that small. So that is why that's important. The Office web applications have their own unique intricacies now. So we've talked about the client and why you shouldn't play with that number, and we're going to tell you what the good number is, the sweet spot. But now we're also going to talk about Office web apps and what happens there.
Yeah. So there is... actually, there's a demo here, but I'm going to go ahead and roll it in one with the next demo as well. So Office web apps, there are these APIs that are sitting above threaded storage. Right? And so why are we talking about these things? Well, it's because they are talking to and utilizing what's happening with the threaded storage. I mentioned there was a partition column in there. If I go in Office web apps and you all fire up multiple sessions editing the same file, all right, you have to start to say, well, I'm going to lock that shred. Or if you start editing and you got lots of sessions and you have lots of pieces and you're adding this piece and this piece, all of a sudden you have a lot of shreds in there for this file, but they all got to be put back together in some meaningful way. So they all build on shredded storage. So interestingly enough, when you go fire up Office web apps and you open up a Word doc or Excel, the actual name, as we'll see in the Fiddler, of the endpoint that's doing all of the work is called OneNote.ashx. How many of you knew that? May I look at that? Oh, we got a person. And what this is doing is it's actually taking the shreds as they come up through the whole APIs, and once it gets a hold of the actual file, it turns it into a JSON array. The entire Word doc, entire Excel is turned into a JSON array, which I mean, honestly, it doesn't have much to do with the shredded storage part, and just the implementation of it was done by one person, which is amazing to me. What will happen is when you go to edit and you change the file, you're going to see, as I demoed the JSON array, everything's broken into a cell. Okay, and that cell, you make that change, only that cell gets sent back. And then only that cell through the web server actually ends up getting updated on the back end shred. So that goes back to the whole concept of, I'm not going to go open up a 20 megabyte document, go all the way down to the bottom, make a change, and the whole 20 meg goes back. It doesn't do that. And we're going to see that. So I'm going to jump right over. And I finally figured out what you guys were saying. I did the magnifier in the VM instead of on my laptop. I'm like, oh my God. All right, so I got it now. So, I'm going to show you. I have the SkyDrive slash business client on here, and you'll see there's nothing in here, right? I'm pointing to a Contoso documents library. I'm going to jump over there, and what I'm going to do is just real simple. This is all live. It's all real. It's all stuff you could do.
So this will be indication of that OneDrive example we talked about, the relationship between the Windows Sapphire components, the clients themselves, the file write chunk size, and its relationship to the database server.
Doc. In Bill, we trust. All right, so we'll do the save. So this is going to obviously go back. It's going to get saved into our document library. And what I have down here is we have the OneDrive. I know this is called SkyDrive. I have both versions installed on here, but they do the same thing. I'm going to go ahead and say sync now. All right, and so what we're going to see in Fiddler is that, you know, I'll come back to this OneNote part, but there are calls being made to cell storage down here. And those calls are simply breaking it into the chunks as you see them come across. I'm not going to go into the protocol because, frankly, we don't have enough time for me to do everything I wanted to show you. But if you look at this, I have a blog where we talk about all the particular actions of things that go on with this cell storage. Now, this is doing the sync. So what I'm going to do, I'm going to come back over here and I'm going to see, yeah, OK, great. This sync, it showed up. And now, why is that important? Well, there is a certain read chunk size that if you set it, you're going to break SkyDrive. You're going to break the OneDrive for business. Okay? And so I'm going to try and get it over there as fast as I can. Now, in terms of the actual dock, I'm going to go ahead and clear out the Fiddler trace. I'm going to go open it back up again. It's not a very big dock, so it's not going to be that big of a JSON array. So when I go over here and I click test, well, I'm not in edit mode, so there's no real reason for it to actually go grab the whole doc, but the moment I say, yeah, let's edit this in Word web app, it's going to go grab the file out of there, it's going to turn it into its JSON array, and everything that's going on in here, that JSON array is being edited, and you see here's our call to the OneNote. The JSON array is coming back, we see all the cells, the different parts of the file, it's getting broken into these objects. And each object represents some little part of that Word doc. So if you look at the, I say, oh, I want Arial font, or I want size 10 or 20. All of that is defined in these little objects that define the styling, defines the words that are inside of it. And again, for the sake of time, what I'm going to do, I'll just come over here and say, well, you know, what if I just go down to the bottom and say, I added this. And I say, save. Again, if this was a massive, huge document, you know, it's not going to go save the whole thing back. And we can see that in the Fiddler trace that there's only a couple of calls that are being made. And there's pings that occur to make sure you're actually logged on. But inside of here, you'll see that we just made this little call. It's just a real small JSON. It just wrote it back. Not a big document, but again, we want to make sure we have time here. But that's where we save on the I/O. It's just pushing that little bitty JSON back. Right? Or when it's doing the pings, as you see the OneNote ASH keeps following up on there, it's actually checking to see if anyone has fired up another editing session. If another editing session happens, that's when you see in the OneOffice web apps, it says, oh, hey, this person's now editing. And then that section gets locked. Right? And then they edit it, and then you say, oh, refresh, and it goes, it just grabs that little section, and then refreshes on the page. All of that is working in concert with shredded storage on the bottom. So now, back to our slides here. There are these configuration things. These are the most important parts. And likely, I have everything to prove out what the questions we're going to ask you, but probably not going to get to run through all those. We'll just ask you the questions, and you guys get lots of prizes. As Bill mentioned earlier, two parameters which you can touch inside of shredded storage, this file write chunk size and the file read chunk size. And so I'm going to let you jam through that while I get this ready.
So the file write chunk size. File read chunk size we introduced in, actually we introduced it in SharePoint Server 2007, and it carried its way into SharePoint 2010, which determined the size of a chunk, an individual chunk that you would read at any given point in time from your database server. With shredded storage, we introduced a new concept called file write chunk size. File write chunk size is not only the target size of the shreds of a file binary, it's also the target size for compound read operations. And again, if you think about that, the target size not only for the shreds of a file binary, but the target size for a compound read operation as well. So again, the thought of a file write chunk size of 2 gigabytes to create a monolithic stream, because it's also the size of the compound read operation, means that it's a 2 gigabyte read. So again, we tie it back to Sapphire. That's why it's so important to understand the intricacy of what file write chunk size is. Most people were working under the assumption that it only affected the target size of a given file binary. It also determines the read size of a given compound read operation. File read chunk size is the size of data that's returned from every stored procedure call to a file binary. This number I wouldn't even mess with because we've deprecated it in SharePoint 2013, and we're going to further deprecate it as we've moved forward because we've moved from COBOL into shredded storage. This algorithm itself isn't easy to figure out. So most people work under the assumption of my average file size is 128K. I'm going to configure a file write chunk size of 64K. So if I do the math, that's going to result in 2 chunks. Those numbers aren't absolutes. That 64K isn't an absolute. The way that our algorithm works is we combine as many blobs as we can together to try to get to the target file write chunk size. In many cases, that may be 64K. It may be 60. It may be larger than that as well. So you can never just use a simple equation such as I'm going to take file write chunk size divisible by the average size of my file, which is going to result, or the result of that operation will be X number of shreds. That doesn't work. And the reason it doesn't work is because what our algorithm does is we try to tell it, combine as many blobs as you can on update operations. So when somebody makes a change and we need to save a delta, we try to combine as many blobs as we can to reach that size. And it's not always going to be 64K. Sometimes it may be larger, sometimes it may be smaller, but it's going to be within that boundary. So it's important to understand that number as well. So next question is what is the right number? So the interesting thing about shredded storage, about COBOL, about file synchronization via SOAP over HTTP and around shredded storage is this isn't a unique SharePoint implementation. Shredded storage was actually developed on the client side, and it's made use of by SkyDrive or OneDrive, the consumer version of the platform. So we've had a lot of experience before we even introduced the technology into SharePoint into what the mean range should be to create blobs that would consistently provide great performance without wasting I/O. So from a sizing perspective, the thing that we like to say is A, you should never exceed 4 megabytes in size because there's going to be a significant I/O penalty because of compound read operations based on the average size of a file that a user stores inside of SharePoint. The average file the average size of a file stored inside of SharePoint today in a collaborative type environment is about 256K, your average Word document. Maybe it's about 1 megabyte. If you exceed 4 megabytes, again, compound read operations, for any given read, you're going to pay that much in penalty. Our recommendation is you find somewhere between either A, keep it at the default of 64K. If you're using RBS or you're using some kind of externalization type solution, keep that number between 2 and 4 megabytes. Don't exceed 4 megabytes. Because of compound operations, you're going to pay a penalty there. And you should also not attempt to go below 64K because then you break our synchronicity with block sizes on disk. That's why we started at 64K to align to that boundary. Again, your optimal setting, largely going to be based on how you use the platform. If it's a store, share, sync type SharePoint solution, so OneDrive for business is your big bet, that's the way users operate, 2 megabytes. If you're using RBS or you have deduplication concerns because you are externalizing or you're using dedupe by virtue of your storage subsystem, then 1 to 4 megabytes, but never exceed 4, never go below 64K. I'm going to go ahead and let Chris talk a little bit about file read chunk size. Again, we're going to be deprecating it in future versions of the product, but it does still have an impact today.
So I'm going to jam through these real fast because I want to make sure you guys get all these prizes and we don't get kicked out. Really, one of the things I did, and you'll see some of the slides, and I'm not going to go into the slides on the Shred Storage Test Frame. You can just go download it. I worked with a lot of ISVs, and we threw a lot of hardware together. We did this, we did that. But what I did is I built this framework. I went and ran these multiple of different tests, many, many. And so did Chris McNulty from Dell. They did a lot of data mining, too. And he has another session. He'll cover some of these things that we didn't hit on. But in reality, what you end up seeing is every time, when you set the file read chunk size to really small, it basically means all those BSNs, when you're putting them together, doesn't really matter. It's going to go grab just little parts of them. So if you set it really small, every call is a stored procedure call. If you set it really small, you get a lot of stored procedure calls, okay, which is not going to be good. Now, there's where the things start to come in. If you have it somewhere around that setting, if you look at the average file size of all your files in your entire content database, it should be somewhere around sitting at 12.5% or higher of whatever your average size is. That's what happens if you set it lower. You'll get down, if it's less than 3% of a particular file size, you're going to get a 50% hit on the performance of getting that file out. And you'll see it in the download speeds when you're trying to do it. Now, so we don't want to go too low, but you also can't go too high. Very similar to the right. And what happened is Bill was like, okay, you got to go test this. And I said, okay, I'll go test that. And then I found something else interesting. There is a setting that if you go too high on this, you will break your OneDrive for business. You will break your SkyDrive client. And you'll get that error right there. Now, if you try to go Google that, there's going to be one result, and there's no response to it on MSDN forums, okay? So I'm just telling you that right now. If you're going to go touch this, you get that. Now you know what you did wrong. So then the question is, well, now you have to know what your average file size is in your database. And there are ways to do that, but I'm not going to point them out. So moving on, again, we want to make sure that we give these prizes out. What the framework was, it was a lot of really cool stuff I threw together. I have APIs that wrap around Fiddler, APIs that wrap around SQL Profiler, that allow you to fire off any test you want to watch how shredded storage does what it does. Okay, and so that's all I'm going to say about it from the sake of time. In terms of a demo, I will probably skip that too, just to throw some stuff. So we're going to give you a knowledge check. Okay.
So the Shredded Storage Testing Framework, probably saw the URL there. Obviously, you'll have access to the deck, but it's the Shredded Storage Testing Framework at CodePlex.
At CodePlex.com.
Download that. It'll give you an idea of what happens during compound read operations as well as write operations, and it allows you to effectively just programmatically leverage different file sizes. So we're going to go ahead and kick it into the knowledge check portion.
We are, because like I said, I want to make sure we give you stuff away. So first question, can you disable shredded storage? I have this football. Okay, I have this football. I'm going to try to do my best, Wilson. I'm going to do my best Wilson, so I'm going to try to go that way. All right, so you get the football, and you could say, this is a true or false question, all right? If you get it right, then this was an easy one, so you're going to get a shirt. But there's some really hard ones, okay? So here we go. Oh, there it goes. Ooh, did we get a catch? Was that a catch? Was that a touchdown? Oh, man. All right, incomplete pass. All right, so, no, you cannot. We got to give the man a thing. So we won't do this part. We'll just go through this. I was originally going to have you guys vote, but for the sake of time, we'll kind of skip through that. No, it cannot be disabled. As Bill mentioned, if you set it to 2 gig, your performance is just going to go horrible. It's just going to be really bad. If you know about certain things, do not touch this particular certain thing. I'm not going to tell you what it is. Bill, we know about it. If you know what it is, the unknown means, it will kill your farm. It's done. It's over. So don't even try to think about turning off shredded storage.
So effectively what Chris is saying is there is an interface that's exposed that you can leverage to effectively disable shredded storage. Doing so will have further implications down the road. Let's say, like, when your users want to upload a document. So, effectively, what you want to do is unless it's a web content management system where you never upload anything and it's pretty static, I wouldn't leverage that inadvertently exposed interface
right.
to...
Whoever has the football, you're now in charge. So you get to throw it somewhere over there. Go for it. Oh, it's got to go past one row. All right, you can do a handoff, sure. All right, there we go. So, true or false, if you set the file write size to 128K, will the size of all shreds be 128K except for the last? Ooh, what do we get? Maybe. It is false. Maybe. That was a good the answer is no, and as you can see from here, in all of this, I have tests with the shredded storage framework that prove this, but we don't have time. So
the next question, as Chris walks that out, is if you set the file write chunk size to a specific file size, will the size of all of the shreds be either A, or let's just say true or false, are they all going to be less than that particular size? So if you set your file write chunk size to 64K, are all of the shreds going to be less than 64K?
Okay, wait. Yeah, we're going that way. Who's ready? He almost tried for it. It was like, all right, whoever picks it up. We have a lot of shirts, but there's only like 40. So whoever you guys answer the questions, you get a shirt, right? So you're guaranteed a shirt. So what do we got?
So I'll go ahead over there for this all right. next question.
Perfect. All right, so he said false, right? Okay, good. So if you were paying attention... Is a lower or higher file read chunk size better for download speeds? I have another football, so we're going to do multi-threaded. Here we go. You ready? I'm like, no, that's not mine. All right. What do we got? What's the answer? That's a good answer. I like it. You were paying it. I like it. He's good. Yeah. Lovely. We got shirts. I'll give him a shirt for that one. All right.
So the next question, each chunk must be executed via a storage.
Oh, the black button.
You see that? Quick recovery.
Good job.
Each chunk itself must be executed via a stored procedure call. So the more calls you make, the more CPU and network activities will be generated.
Perfect. All right. Oh, yeah, we got that.
Oh, did we just do that one?
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah. Ooh, so okay, this is a good one.
Images, right.
This is a book one.
This is a book question. Images in Word and PowerPoint files are broken into their own shreds.
Ooh, this is tricky. Tricky one. All right, here we go. I'm going to try to go farther. I'm going Kaepernick style. Oh, no. sorry, I had to.
All right, so the answer to question number 5, true or false, images in Word and PowerPoint files are broken into their own shreds. All right, question number 6, shredded storage applies to all instances of the same binary file. So effectively, if I take file foo, and I upload it to 2 different document libraries, it's shredded twice.
All right, here we go. Middle, going. Okay.
So again, the question was, is shredded storage will apply to all instances of the same file binary? Are you ready? Who's got the ball?
He's got the ball.
So it works at the list item level. So every time you upload to a file document library, a new list item is generated. So therefore, there's no dedupe across libraries themselves.
That was a good try, though. That was good.
So one of the things that you can do is, again, he talked about the shredded storage testing framework. Leveraging that, you'll see all of these operations occur. So this is a way for you to proof out shredded storage without actually having to do it on a production system. So question number 7, as we're running low on time, for sure, changing the title property of a version document will create a new shred.
Oh, look at that. Falses and trues. Okay, all right, here we go. We're going. All right, we got to go.
All right.
He's going for false. Uh-oh.
Oh, no.
Oh. Now, okay, so it's actually true and false depending on the circumstance. So it's a trick question for the most, But it's there for, if you go back real quick, it's there. If you edit, this has nothing to do with shred storage, by the way. Okay, if you edit a Word doc, it always has that title in it. And when you edit the title with SharePoint, it changes the doc. Oh, and if you only have one shred, guess what's going to happen? New shred. Nothing to do with shredded storage, by the way. It's just something that happens at SharePoint higher level. All right, so one last question. It is worth...
All right, question number 8.
If you can get within like 0.5 megabytes, then you get a book. Otherwise, you get a shirt for sure.
What's the maximum file write chunk size that you can configure and everything will remain operational? So Fabian threw my ball down there since he had to throw it 8 feet over my head.
Hands. All right, hands right there.
He's that way back there.
We got 4 megs. Too low, but you get a shirt. All right, what else? Who? Pick another person. True. Okay, true. All right. Yeah. So, how about, okay, here. Whoa, no, 2 gig, no 2 gig, okay. All right, I don't know if that's worth a shirt. We have 3 meg. No, we want to go higher from 4. You already have a shirt. Okay, Fabian? We already did 4. I said higher. All right, what do we got? Oh, okay. All right.
So this question was a little bit unfair because we didn't show you OneDrive for Business, but it's about 8.25 megs. That is when that wasted I.O. penalty gets to such an extreme that it'll actually break. So that was kind of a trick question. So Chris is going to have to give the book to somebody anyway.
Yeah.
So I'll let Chris pick somebody out of the audience to give a book to, since he threw a trick question at you. And in the meantime, what's that? So from a recommendations perspective, A, don't modify the file write chunk size without any kind of justification. And if you do so, keep it limited to about 4 meg as a maximum boundary. The preferable boundary is between 2 and 4 megabytes. OneDrive for Business is a 2 megabyte preferred configuration. 1 to 4 megabytes for any other type operations, such as RBS or deduplication concerns or needs, again, because you're going to affect compound read operations by virtue of the Sapphire stack, the native code stack inside of Windows Vista that we introduced all the way up through to include Windows 8.1. Your file read chunk size should be proportional to your average file size, as Chris talked about. That has an implication on the other side of things. So we're talking about bandwidth versus storage itself. 12.5%. And bringing that back is the optimal for normalized operations.
Yep.
As you exceed that, it'll continue to grow. Lastly, you should always test shredded storage with RBS as well as your storage vendor in the event that you are using RBS for acceptable performance, because there are different types of performance penalties that you'll play that will come into play in different types of operations, such as externalization type scenarios. So in a summary, shredded storage is a pretty cool thing. Shredded storage of the future is even a cooler thing. Read and write chunk sizes are going to be different for various workloads. It can't be disabled despite a notorious interface that enables you to do so. And with the combination of RBS and dedupe, you should always test things for performance, because you have rehydration that you have to think about in the addition of recompilation of the blob from a shredded storage perspective. So we are out of time. I believe there are some other presenters that may be waiting to take the stage from us, but I'm going to make my way kind of outside if anybody has any additional questions they want to ask. There's
tonight.
An evening event tonight from 5 to 7 with Mudezik, and don't forget your survey.
Plenty of shirts. First come, first serve.